Sheldon Primus.
Welcome to the Safety Consultant Show with Sheldon Primus, where we blend safety smarts with business brilliance and a pinch of Sheldon's signature wit. Whether you're a safety pro, a fresh-faced consultant, or just safety curious, get ready for a show that'll educate, entertain, and elevate your safety game. Let's dive into the art of consulting with your safety Sherpa himself, Sheldon Primus.
This episode is powered by Safety FM.
Hey, happy Monday to everybody. I hope you're all doing well. Welcome to the Safety Consultant Show. I'm Sheldon Primus. Good boy, right here, hanging. And I am back in Ocala. So that means I don't have, if anything happens, of course I'm not in a sound studio, but, you know, honestly, from time to time, you know, I got to worry about in the RV, if it's raining, then it sounds horrible with rain against an RV. I need to come up with like an RV tent or something that could go over it so you guys don't get that deluge of rain. And I try not to record during those days, so you guys didn't hear it much unless I'm doing an interview. But welcome back. How are y'all doing? Glad to hear. And the way I hear is hearing from you, sharing the show, you talking to each other through the social medias, and so a hearing with my eyes, I guess. I don't know how that would work, but glad everybody's doing well and enjoying the show. Thank you so much. And as my habit is, I like to see where everyone's from. So I'm doing a nice little search on my Beecast, and I've got the world's largest, loudest mouse. So you guys are going to hear that clicking and clicking. Yeah, I'll zoom into that. Oh, yes. So anyway, let's see where everybody's coming from, right? So first, let's look at the Beecast list. And let's see, US, France, Netherlands, Spain, Austria, Finland, UK, South Africa, Denmark, Thailand, Canada, New Zealand, Saudi Arabia, India, Belgium, Namibia, Korea. Awesome. Wow, everyone, thank you so much. That is really cool. I'm going to flip over to my chartable list, and this is telling me my positions in each country as far as where I am in my category, which is government. That's my primary category. So let's see. In Denmark, I am 233 on Apple. Oh, man, you guys rock. Thank you so much. Chile, I am number 52 on the Apple podcast for my category. Kenya, I am number 78 in your category. And for number one is Oman. I am number 29. And
finish him.
Yes, you guys rock.
Yeah!
Hold on, here's another one. Thanks, everybody, for just hanging out with me. I know sometimes I get a little silly, and sometimes I'm just having some fun. So, and then we get serious too, right? Because that is our way. Yeah, holistically, right? Gotta check everything out. Okay, we are in the podcast, chartables list for our government reach. I am 177. So thank you, gang, for not only listening to me, but sharing me with your buddies and those that you believe are really would get value. How's that? We get value from this. And that's reflected, because I wouldn't make any of these charts without you guys sharing it. And thank you so much. US, can you help me get on the Apple chart, if you don't mind? The US market. So if you're listening to me on the US market first, follow the show. That's you. It's a part that you guys could support me. It means a bunch, because it helps the reach of the show. That's really what it boils down to. And I've got an interview today, which is awesome, but I just want to let you guys know that this is me entering my fourth year in the show. So I have completed year three. I've got a fourth anniversary is what it shows on my calendar here. So maybe the end of this year, I should have my 300 episodes or beginning next year. So that's pretty cool. I'll have to work that thing out in my brain. All right. So sorry, you're going to hear some rustling of papers. That's me going to just writing down some show notes, because this is really awesome who we have today. We've got Jordan Barab, and if you are not familiar with Jordan, Deputy Assistant Secretary of Labor at the Occupational Safety and Health Administration. You guys know that place, right? That place is OSHA, which is awesome. And so Jordan was in OSHA at the same time as Dr. Michaels was. So together, they were leading OSHA with a whole bunch of safety and health policies during that time period. He took his experience from being at the CSB, Chemical Safety Board, and even working at the Senate, because honestly, you will need to navigate politics when you get to that level of OSHA. And he was working with the Senate before that and got brought on board with the team. So I am really, really happy that we had this conversation, got a chance to talk, and he was very gracious with his time. We talked about the OSHA Technical Institute Education Centers. We talked about just the regulatory agenda, a few things on there. He helped me figure out a few areas where it was the fact or fiction episodes on the episodes, or at least event that we talked about, which is me giving Jordan just a couple of things that I teach my students, and I just want to make sure that I'm on the right track. I don't want to mislead them in any way. As I tell all the students, I'm here for you, and I honestly want you to get the right answer and to be able to function well with OSHA when you do have to work with OSHA. You guys are on the same side. It's just you're sometimes have to take different positions, but that's okay. You have to protect your clients as a consultant, but the bottom line is we're all on the same team, trying to make sure that the workers are going to have their rights and they're going to be protected. So I really enjoy this conversation. We talked about the OSHA budget and how important it is. For those of you that may have started listening to the show, because I used to do a presentation for the ASSP, American Societies for Safety Professionals, and the presentation I used to do called is The Future of OSHA. So I'm sure if you just look up ASSP, Future of OSHA, you'll see me presenting there. And the way that I would do it was just looking through the budget. And no one likes to read the budget. It's a terrible thing that you got to do sometimes, and compliance letters and all that stuff. But in order to be a effective consultant, you got to know that stuff. So I did a presentation a few years in a row for ASSP on the future of OSHA. And the future of OSHA I did was just a breakdown of the budget. And you definitely know what is important to an organization by its budget, especially if this budget has to be approved by Congress. So that's one of the ways and some of my information. So we talked a little bit about that. We talked a little bit about the field operation manual, the current COSHOs, how now we've got some really young COSHOs coming in, and talked about enforcement units, human organization performance versus VBS a little bit, days away, restricted transfer rates. We talked about those things, and it was really a good conversation. Even the OSHA vaccine policy, if you guys remember that, we were able to talk about that one as well. So I think you guys are going to have a wonderful time this episode, and really just get a good understanding of Mr. Jordan Barab. And man, I was just blown away by some of the things that just my understanding now has gained quite a bit about OSHA and regulatory just in this conversation. So I know you guys are going to enjoy it. So there you go. And just as a notification, none of us got a sound studio. You know, I got a soundboard, and with my soundboard, I could do some stuff, but I ain't got a sound like studio.
Epic fail.
You guys just get me with the board. So, in saying that, you may hear some background noise. I did my best editing, but, you know, I'm just a solely podcaster, and you'll hear maybe dog barking. That's all right. We're doing life, and you're getting this episode as we're doing life, right? So, without any further ado, Mr. Jordan Barab.
Hi, my name is Jordan Barab. I was Deputy Assistant Secretary at the Occupational Safety and Health Administration throughout the entire Obama administration. I also worked for 16 years for the American Federation of State, County, Municipal Employees, running their the union's health and safety program. I've worked for about 4 years in the House of Representatives doing occupational safety and health work, and 4 years at the Chemical Safety Board, where we investigated chemical plant accidents and recommendations coming out of those incidents.
Such a incredible resume to me, and I'm sure the people listening too. You know, I don't want to just focus in on your OSHA part, because you're just so much more than that. How did you get started in just your safety journey altogether?
Well, it's an interesting story. I actually had no background in occupational safety and health. I had actually have a degree in international relations. I had been doing various jobs, and I ended up working for an environmental group that did some work with OSHA, trying to get environmentalists more involved in workplace safety and health. I was hired at AFSCME in 1982, and they didn't have anybody. They didn't have a health and safety program, and I was sort of interested. So they basically said I could do that part time, which turned out to be a lot more interesting. First, it was a lot more interesting than the other work I was supposed to be doing. And second, there was kind of a myth there that AFSCME members, which were public employees, didn't really have many health and safety problems. And I'm saying that was a myth because they had a lot of health and safety problems, but they never brought them to the union because the union didn't do anything. So it was kind of a vicious circle, which I broke because I basically communicated to our membership that, yes, there was now somebody concerned about their safety on the job, and we were immediately flooded with interest in, you know, how to fix things, you know, get training, you know, how to where relevant, how to file OSHA complaints. Turns out there were enormous problems, health and safety problems in the union. And I was there for 16 years and built a, you know, fairly substantial program, partly, you know, through the union, partly with various government grants from OSHA and CDC and other government agencies to really, you know, focus in on the health and safety hazards that public employees were facing.
Your experience with the public sector, that's one of the things that first drew me to you, because I was a public sector worker. And one of the things was, I don't know if you remember in Florida, way back, CSB did an actual, just went over to a wastewater plant, Bethune-Cookman plant in Daytona.
In Daytona, yeah, the Bethune wastewater treatment plant in Daytona. Daytona.
Yeah.
I was there. Yeah, I went out to that investigation. Yeah.
And that's when I first saw you, because that rocked our world in water and wastewater treatment, that whole system.
Yeah.
And what happened there, and you guys could, those listening, just look up the CSB Bethune-Cookman plant case study. It was really amazing, and just completely avoidable welding in an area where they shouldn't have been and caused an explosion. And for us, without an OSHA, state OSHA plan, we just knew that we needed to talk to our employers and implore them to please do the bare minimum. And they never did any of your recommendations with the state recommendations that you guys put out there.
Well, yeah, and Sheldon, maybe we should go back, because I don't know if people know this, but, you know, public employees were not covered by the Occupational Safety and Health Act. They were exempted, except in those first 21 states that run their own programs, And then OSHA also gave states the opportunity to run public employee only programs where the feds would still enforce private sector and the state would enforce the public sector, and the state would get 50% of its funding from the federal government to do that. Unfortunately, only six states have done that. So added that to the 21 states that have the full state plans, you know, that makes 27 states. So there's still 23 states in this country where public employees don't have OSHA coverage, where they have essentially no legal right to a safe workplace. And Florida, you know, was one of those states, or still is one of those states.
Yeah, and honestly, like, I know we're skipping far ahead, but during the pandemic time, when our governor, our current governor, was trying to pull away from regulations, and he was saying, we're going to run our own state plan. And I'm thinking, yes, please, because you got to be compliant within 6 months. So go ahead. I want that. And I didn't know if I needed to tell him that or not, but I was like, all right.
Well, he also didn't read the fine print that even if you run your own program, you still have to adopt all the federal standards. So that wouldn't have helped his problem. But you're right. It would have gotten public employee coverage. So that would have been a plus.
Yeah. And I was thinking, fine, we could do a consent order for OSHA to run parts of the state that you don't want to take over. Those are good. Right. For those of you that don't understand, with government sectors, if a government agency has to run part of your program that's out of compliance with their federal rules, which mm-hmm. takes precedent over the states, they'll do what's called a consent order. They'll kind of take over. So you remember that time, and from the CDC, from the CSB, when you moved into OSHA with Dr. Michaels as being his second, you didn't have to go through the help process, did you, with the Senate?
No. I was, you know, when the Obama administration started, I was working in the House of Representatives, and they needed somebody over there immediately to run the organization. And you're right. I mean, the deputies do not have to be Senate confirmed. So it was pretty easy to get me over there. I was there for almost a year until December when Dr. Michaels was confirmed finally by the Senate. But yeah, that was the advantage to not being Senate confirmed, because I could get over there literally. I think they called me up, and you know, I was over there in a week and a half by the time I tied up things in the House.
Wow. And with the health committee, health, employment, labor, pension, those are the people who, when you get someone that's a candidate for OSHA, they have to go through that, through the Senate approval, and get approved. And the poor guy from FedEx, I believe, who was waiting forever for Senate approval to the degree that he stopped and he pulled his name away from it during the Trump years. I forget his name, but man, that was a tough one just during that time period to see no head of OSHA and just acting heads of OSHA. That was tough.
Yeah,
for
it
me.
Was because
what about you?
Yeah, no, I was working part of that first couple of years of the Trump administration. I was retired, and then I went back to work during the final 2 years in the House of Representatives. Yeah, and it was problematic because you know you had starting in 2020 you had COVID, which was a major problem, deadly problem for workers all over the country, especially healthcare workers, and you really had very little leadership at OSHA. I mean, partly because there was no assistance. Secretary, partly because it was the Trump administration that was not particularly interested in occupational safety and health and worker safety. So it was kind of a bad combination during a particularly bad time in the country.
Yeah, and I have a business partner who's ex-OSHA. He was 27 years with OSHA, Kevin Yarbrough, in the Tampa office. And during the time period, Yarbrough was telling me how a lot of the people that were in OSHA, they were getting poached by the private sector, which, you know, always happens. But it was like in really big numbers during that time period where it seemed like the higher ups were willing to get to leave because they felt like at that point, and again, this is just his inside information. This is nothing. It was tough for them.
Yeah, no, it was. And it, I mean, it's always a problem at OSHA, people leaving and getting paid more in the private sector than they do as a federal employee, especially once they get trained up, especially for those who have, you know, a specialty like process safety management, you know, chemical plant safety. It's a problem. They do get hired up. And it's more of a problem in the, you know, in the states that run their own state programs, because they're generally paid far less even than the feds are. And you know, even federal OSHA often picks up a lot of its best inspectors from the state plans because, again, they pay so poorly.
Yeah, that's stuff that no one will really know. But when you dig into OSHA, you dig into the budget, you see the FTE hours and all that that's going to go from for all the efforts. I still think the budget is and the field operation manual. Those two things for me as a consultant, whenever I have to represent a client and I have to go into an informal conference or anything, I still have to get coached up on some of the things related to the budgetary requirements, because that's going to tell me what kind of officer is going to be out in the field, and it'll also tell me how many years, generally speaking. And when Dr. Michaels and you came up with the enforcement units, that was a big change, because, you know, a lot of the field officers were just kind of like shooting fish in a barrel on construction sites and getting promotions and everything else until the EUs came out, and then they had to do some work to get some more recognition, and that messed everybody up.
Well, that was always... It was always, I mean, the story, you know, although we didn't have strict quotas, you know, every region was expected to, you know, make, you know, X number of inspections every year. And, you know, at the end of the year, if they hadn't made their numbers, it was always easy to go out to a big construction site and just do a whole bunch of construction citations. And unfortunately, I mean, that was, you know, that was what it was. But unfortunately, what that meant was because, you know, essentially all inspections were created equal. That meant that people were reluctant, you know, to do the more difficult ones, especially the ones that dealt with a general duty clause case where there wasn't an OSHA standard. It could be ergonomics, workplace violence, you know, certain infectious diseases. Those always took longer than your average case, especially a construction case. And so, you know, if you're only focused on the numbers of inspections, you know, that was kind of a disincentive to taking those cases. And once we went to enforcement units and we kind of gave more units to the more difficult cases, I think it really kind of evened out that the focus on the more difficult inspections. Unfortunately, that was kind of dismantled again during the Trump administration. I think they're trying to put it back together at OSHA. I'm not exactly sure whether they've succeeded in putting it all back together again. But basically, it is always a struggle to, you know, to get people to do the more difficult cases that may take a long time to do.
Yeah. And I teach a lot of classes regarding OSHA compliance with a group that is OTIEC. And one of the things that I always tell my students, and help me with maybe a round of fact or fiction right here. So one of the things that I tell my students is, generally speaking, if you have a Democrat in office for president, they're going to end up doing more, OSHA will end up being more compliance enforcement. And if you have a Republican in office, it's more compliance assistance, if any compliance. And that's the first thing. Fact or fiction on that one? Let's start with that.
Yeah, I think that's fact. Democrats, I think, are more focused on, you know, ensuring compliance and focusing on enforcement and focusing on, you know, those employers that are really not in compliance with the Occupational Safety and Health Act or with good, you know, good practices. Republicans are always saying, well, we shouldn't be so confrontational. We should just work together and, you know, that kind of thing, which, you know, it's again, what you said, I think, is generally true, but it's not black or white, because we did an enormous amount of compliance assistance. I think the difference between our compliance assistance and the average Republican compliance assistance is that we really tried to focus our compliance assistance on particularly vulnerable workers, you know, maybe immigrants or non-union or non-English speaking workers, those who are most vulnerable and least likely to know how to use their rights or least willing to use their rights. And Republicans tend to focus on, you know, on providing assistance assistance to companies, things like the Voluntary Protection Program, they're much more enthusiastic about, I think, than Democratic administrations are. So that, you know, but on the other hand, the Republicans also do a lot of enforcement when they're there. That, you know, there are certain cases that you have to take, whether you're Republican or Democrat. If somebody's killed in the workplace, if there's a complaint, or there's a serious incident, you know, whether you're Republican or Democrat, you're going to go out and investigate it, and you're going to probably cite. And, you know, I mean, the gray area is how big are the citations going to be? How many willfuls are there going to be? And again, you know, Democrats generally will have, you know, the larger cases than the Republicans. But again, it's not totally black and white where, you know, Republicans just stop doing enforcement, or Democrats stop doing compliance assistance. Everybody, you know, is required by law to do both, essentially.
Yeah. And I did see in the budget when President Biden came in that he actually spent a lot of money on both. Yeah, he decided that, you know, we're going to do some enforcement and then we're going to do both. I know with you and Dr. Michaels, when you're in office there, you really worked on the psychological side of encouraging bosses to do the right thing, you know, such as...
David was very focused on showing companies that they could be more successful and more profitable if safety was an integral part of their business plan, essentially. And that was always a struggle with some employers, but I think that was very useful to go along with our fairly aggressive enforcement program.
Yeah, and honestly, I thought it was fair, especially with your focus. I know right now it was just going back to it, but the focus on turning your record keeping rule that you made with the electronic record keeping into a lagging indicator for safety and health, turning that into a leading indicator that will help you find out which areas are going to be underreporting, which areas you need to enforce more the days away restricted transfer rates. So I honestly think now that OSHA is going back to that original concept that you guys came up with, that's going to help you help OSHA with their resource management by taking a good look at injury illness data coming in with the 300, mm-hmm. 301s and the 300A logs. Honestly, I feel like that going back to that, Doug Parker, I honestly think that the original intent that you guys had was really good. Okay, I'm a consultant and more regulation helps me. So that's the bottom line. I know that But I always tell students and everyone that you and OSHA are on the same side. You're doing things differently, but you're on the same side. You want the workers to come back healthy and everything else. So that record keeping rule that's coming back, it seems like that's touching back to what you guys work your intent for your resources for your budget to make sure that you're going to get every bang for the buck you can by taking a lagging indicator and turning it into a leading indicator. Is that fair to say?
It's funny, the record keeping changes, you know, requiring employers to send more of that into OSHA and publicizing that information as well so the public can see it, it's kind of seen as the employer, you know, groups like to see that as kind of an anti-business kind of thing, but it really is something that should help everybody. I mean, it helps OSHA obviously focus its resources. OSHA doesn't have a lot of resources, so it's important for them to focus on the most dangerous workplaces. But, you know, and the public should know, you know, which companies are doing better and which companies are doing worse. But it should be also useful for employers because, as you indicate, that helps employers identify where the problems are in their workplaces and where they have to do the most work. It's kind of a win-win-win for everybody. To have that information not only collected, but actually publicized as well.
Yeah, quite honestly, in a market like this, when you're looking to, when more people have options, you could now seriously look at if someone knew. Obviously, you have to know about safety and health, and you have to know to look and see some of the data that's going to, of course, the personal information is going to be scrubbed, but the data that's available is going to let you know, hey, this company's got a good record, or goodness, this severe violators list that you guys created. You know, I literally tell people about companies on that list, and I'm like, I can't shop there. Yeah. I just can't shop there.
Right. And, you know, it also helps for companies can compare themselves with other companies, and not only in their geographic area, but in their sector, in their industrial sector. So they kind of don't just know how they're doing in isolation. They know how how they're doing, you know, compared to their competitors. So again, it's very useful information.
And anybody who's ever went to a restaurant and you looked at Google and you look for that rating to see which restaurant you go to and how many stars, it's the same concept that we're talking about right here.
Exactly. Yeah.
Here's another round of fact and fiction here. I tell my students all the time, and I hear this, especially in the construction site, that OSHA comes and they'll shut the job down. And I'm like, not exactly. Am I right in saying that you guys don't have the power to shut the job down without some assistance?
That would be nice. That would be a useful power to have if OSHA had it. The only thing that comes close to that is OSHA does have the authority to shut down jobs, not whole sites, but jobs if there's an imminent danger. Unfortunately, OSHA can't just, you know, shut it down. I mean, if the employer objects to that, then OSHA ends up having to go to court to get that enforced. So it's not even that's not easy to enforce its imminent danger authority. But no, OSHA can't obviously shut down a business, and they can't shut down a whole plant even if there's a dangerous part of it. All they can do is cite, or again, in the imminent danger situations, shut down maybe a machine or a process or a you know, specific, you know, part of the workplace.
All right, man, nailed it. All right, another one of these misconceptions that I get all the time is people say, well, OSHA only regulates people with 10 or more employees. And my response to them is, look at the budget. It's literally in the second page of the budget. You got 6 items that OSHA could cite you for if you're a small employer. It's just they choose not to spend much money on it. So am I leading people wrong on that one?
We'll be back with more of Sheldon Primus and the Safety Consultant Show in just a moment. Are you ready to make a difference? Introducing the Safety Consultant Blueprint Course. Unlock your potential as a safety consultant. Learn the skills, strategies, and ethics to create safer workplaces for your very own client. From risk assessment to client acquisition, we've got you covered. Become a safety consultant and open doors to being your own boss. Join us and be the hero of workplace safety. Enroll today. Safety starts with you. Take the first step now. Visit our website and enroll in the Safety Consultant Blueprint Course. Empower businesses. Protect lives. SafetyConsultantBlueprint.com. We now return to the Safety Consultant Show. Once again, here's Sheldon Primus.
Well, the small employer thing is always a problem. I mean, not a real problem, but I mean, kind of a public relations political problem. I mean, anytime we'd go to hearings or do anything the least bit controversial or put out a new regulation or standard, the immediate response from the business community is, oh, no, it's going to kill small business. I mean, that's always the first response. It's going to kill small business. OSHA's unfair to small business, you know, et cetera, et cetera. There's several things to say about that. I mean, first of all, what they're asking for very often is, you know, small businesses should be getting a pass, especially on the first violation, or the fine shouldn't be as low. But I mean, you know, our feeling was, first of all, your right to a safe workplace, your right to come home alive and healthy at the end of a workday, should not be determined by the size of the company you work for. You know, somebody working for a company that has, you know, 10 or 12 people has just as much a right to, you know, come home alive and healthy at the end of the day as somebody working for a huge corporation. Number one. Number two, OSHA does understand that, you know, small businesses have, you know, problems in compliance. You know, a big company can hire health and safety staff. You know, they can hire consultants. You know, a very small company doesn't have that kind of, you know, cash often to do that. So to respond to that, OSHA has its consultation program, its on-site consultation program. Every state has an on-site consultation program funded 90% by federal OSHA to address the concerns of small businesses, small and medium-sized businesses. And essentially, small and medium-sized businesses can get what is essentially a free OSHA inspection without the risk of enforcement or citation from that, on-site consultation program. So in essence, that kind of resolves the request that small businesses get a pass the first time they're inspected. They can get a free inspection without, risk of a citation. Now, you were indicating, though, and one thing you mentioned, which is somewhat true, there is congressional language. It's sort of called a rider that gets attached to OSHA's budget every single year that keeps OSHA from conducting programmed inspections for small business, certain small businesses. Depending on their injury and illness rate and what industry they're in. So things like, planned inspections, if your injuries and illnesses are too high, or OSHA emphasis programs can't apply to certain small businesses. But that's pretty much the only restriction. They're still required to comply with the law. They're still obviously open to being cited if they are not in compliance. So they're not at all exempt from OSHA. They just aren't going to be inspected quite as much. And that is a problem, especially with small construction companies where you have trouble finding them, even much less citing them.
Yeah.
And then the other kind of atrocity, I think, is farms, small farms. There's also a congressional rider that prohibits OSHA not just from inspecting small farms in emphasis programs and programmed inspections, but OSHA's not allowed to set foot on a small farm ever for any reason to provide compliance assistance. You could have, 9 people killed on a farm and OSHA wouldn't be able to ever inspect it even. So that's really, that's kind of a legacy from way back in the 70s, unfortunately, which we've never quite been able to get rid of. But there are a lot of people working on farms that get killed, on small farms get killed that OSHA's never able not only to cite, but you can't even investigate, and even get any lessons learned out of that. So it's really kind of tragic for workers on those small farms.
Is that because of the ruling with you have to be family in order for OSHA to get jurisdiction at that point? And are they kind of like expanding the whatever family means at that point?
Yeah, that's more kind of a wage and hour thing where, family members are not necessarily considered employees. If you're a family member, you're not an employee, and OSHA wouldn't have jurisdiction, even if it's a large farm, for example. You can't cite someone for their kid if they're on the family farm. That's somewhat of a problem, but this thing is just anybody working on a small farm, and it does so kind of stem from kind of the myth of the small family farm. And you don't want these terrible government inspectors raiding somebody small family farm, but a lot of these are not small family farms. They're small, but they got a bunch of employees there. So it's not the kids that are working. It's the the employees. They just happen to be working on a smaller farm. And as I said before, that they should have the same rights to come home alive at the end of the day as somebody working on a large farm.
Hey, I had you mentioned it earlier with ergonomics, and I know with 2000 when the Congressional Review Act went after President Bush came into office and President Clinton was leaving, in those magical 6 months when you could do the Congressional Review Act and pull something out. Is it fair to say that now you can never have an ergonomics rule? It only has to be a 5A1 because of the way the ergonomics rule was taken out of office or taken out of the law?
It's not totally clear. What the Congressional Review Act says, that if a standard is repealed by Congress, then OSHA cannot issue any kind of standard that is, I think the words are, substantially the same as the standard that was repealed. So nobody's ever really tested that. So the theory has been that, although OSHA can't issue at this point a comprehensive ergonomic standard, which that one would have been, that covered everybody. If OSHA just, for example, did a ergonomic standard focused on healthcare workers or just focused on, you know, construction workers, that might be acceptable. But again, nobody's ever tested that. So we don't really know what the limits of that are and what restrictions that would imply. OSHA's just never gotten around to, you know, having the resources to really focus on that at this point. So we don't really know.
I guess now I'm going to have to keep an eye on the regulatory agenda and see if Doug Parker might want to take that on.
I mean, when we were there, we were strongly considering doing an ergonomic standard for healthcare. We decided instead, because we have, you know, obviously a finite number of resources, and in consulting with a lot of the stakeholders, that if we wanted to address a lot of the injuries and illnesses in healthcare, it was more useful at that point to focus on workplace violence in healthcare. And we did put that on the regulatory agenda, I think, in 2016. OSHA's still working on that.
I keep thinking, like, when you guys did the update in 2016 for the injury illness prevention program that Cal OSHA has, and the voluntary version of it, I keep thinking that eventually federal OSHA is going to want to make that some sort of law too. And this seems like the right time to do it, especially if there's Biden win for next year, then everybody's got a little bit more breathing room. So it seemed like, you know, that might be the right time to do it.
I mean, that's a painful issue, because at the beginning of the Obama administration, that was our main focus, was to do an injury and illness prevention program. And unfortunately, you know, OSHA is very slow on its regulatory progress always. We didn't get around to doing the very first step of that, which is the small business review process, until after the 2010 election. And if you remember the 2010 election, you know, the Democrats got killed, and there was an enormous amount of anxiety about whether Obama would be reelected in 2012. And they basically, you know, shut down our whole regulatory process there. So the injury and illness prevention program idea kind of died. And by the time, you know, Obama's reelected and we kind of got back on track, there were too many other priorities like the silica standard and the beryllium standard that were close to finishing, that we ended up putting our resources into instead of that standard, which there was no way we would have been able to finish during a second term.
Well, that makes some sense there too, because that's when the House and the Senate end up flipping and just kind of lost the support that you guys had.
Yeah. Well, it wasn't so much that we needed congressional support. I mean, that's always nice. They can't do much to us except for cut our budget, which they couldn't do because they didn't have enough votes, or again, Congressional Review Act. It was more, you know, more political considerations coming from the White House there that kind of stopped that, because, you know, mainly, again, because of the results of the 2010 election.
You know, I know I want to get to life now too, but since I have you, and you've been on the other side of the table for someone like me doing, well, it won't be an informal conference when it gets to that level of OSHA. It's going to be a notice of contest. What's some of the tips that you've seen successful consultants do whenever they're showing up in an area office, if you have any of that information?
Well, I think, you know, companies that, it's not really this black and white, but I mean, you have certain companies that are clearly showing a complete disregard for the safety and health of their workers. And those are kind of the bad guys. But, you know, there are a lot of companies that, you know, they just, again, don't, you know, they overlooked something, or they, you know, just didn't have enough, felt like they didn't have enough money to invest in safety, and they really wanted to, and they're, you know, sincerely interested in making their, you know, their workplace safe. And I think, you know, during the informal conference or the post citation contest negotiations, I think it's you know, it's important for employers to really, you know, show that they take safety and health seriously, and they're willing to go to any lengths, you know, not only to comply with OSHA, but really to go above and beyond OSHA, because OSHA standards really are kind of the floor. I mean, it's always easy to to go above and beyond most OSHA standards. And I think, just showing that willingness and proving that willingness to, to fix immediately whatever problems there are and to put safeguards in to ensure that those problems won't reemerge, I think is probably the best thing that, you know, the employers can do when after they're cited, you know, by OSHA. And of course, you know, coming from OSHA, we prefer, you know, that employers would just, I mean, you know, perhaps negotiate something in the informal process, but then just, you know, pay the fine and move on and, you know, invest your time and energy and resources into making your workplace safer.
Yeah, fair enough. That's good. So now that you've left OSHA and from, you know, it's been a little time period now, how has life changed, especially getting back into your confined space writing and the blogging there? And if you're doing any consultancy and speaking, what was that transition like?
Yeah, I'm not doing a whole lot of consulting. I this is my second retirement, and now I've got grandchildren. The first retirement, I did a lot more consulting. Now I'm not doing quite as much. I'm mostly just writing. And it's kind of fun. I mean, it's always easier to be outside and kibitzing than inside. As a friend of mine used to say, it's easier throwing bombs than it is catching them. Yeah, I think I have, you know, I certainly have a lot of experience in this area. And part of what I try to do now is really educate, you know, workers who don't necessarily understand OSHA and what the process is and what their rights are and what their tools, the tools they have. I'm trying to educate, you know, younger people who are just coming into the field, trying to kind of excite them about getting into the occupational safety and health field, because we need more people, smart people to get into that area. I think a lot of my focus is also on the press, on the media, because, I follow, obviously, I read almost everything that's printed everywhere on occupational safety and health. A lot of it, you know, you have reporters that just really don't understand what OSHA does or understand the process. And I try to also educate them. A lot of times they'll reach out to me to, you know, ask me about how OSHA works about a specific incident. Sometimes I'll reach out to them when I see an article that, that is just wrong. I will reach out to them. And a lot of times reporters will respond and will follow up. And again, that is a process of, you know, really educating the public about what OSHA does and the importance of what it does and how it works. Unfortunately, there's not many other people out there really doing that. I think it's a useful service. And I enjoy it. I always have enjoyed writing advocating for workplace safety and health.
Yeah, and you do a great job, and I try to repost everything I see on my LinkedIn whenever I see it coming in, because I know that you've got so much insight, you got experience, and then you've got the trusted voice in our community in safety and health.
Yeah, I'm often criticized for being a little too political, and I certainly don't shy away from politics. But I do reject the accusation sometimes that I'm making health and safety political. Unfortunately, it is political. I mean, it always has been political. Almost ever since OSHA was created, it's been very political with, especially the Republicans attacking it and attacking, you know, the regulatory state, attacking, the alleged oppression of small businesses and trying to cut OSHA's budget in Congress. And it just is a political process. So I'm a player in that, but I certainly, you know, did not create it. And I'm just trying to, you know, explain to people, what the arguments are, for a strong Occupational Safety and Health Administration, for strong workplace safety and health protections.
Yeah, and that's one of the areas, meaning the political side, that me, when I'm an instructor and I have to wear my OTI, which is OSHA Training Institute Education Center, for those of you that aren't familiar with that acronym, OTIEC. When I'm wearing my OSHA hat for that side as being a representative of them through the training center, I definitely shy away from any of those talks and trying to point that out. And I'm just looking at hazard exposure, and what can we do with that? But then when I put on my consulting hat and I'm teaching students who want to be certified trainers, and and certified safety specialists, I tell them, you have to look for, to be successful in this field, you got to look at the regulatory agenda. You've got to look at who's going to be in the office or not, because that's going to truly lead. You got to look at your specific area. If you're a state plan, then you got to figure out, you know, go talk to the state administrator and talk to them and see what's happening. And you'll have to find out that when administrations change, right or wrong, OSHA changes. And one of the things, especially during the pandemic, when we finally had the vaccines and OSHA took the hit over trying to make it mandatory, you know, for me, I'm thinking, well, that's the difference between a performance standard and a specification standard. You know, having a mandated COVID vaccine for a workplace is a specification standard instead of performance, where we are now. You know, you want to get vaccinated, it's up to you, but you got to protect the workers. So that's what I tell them usually. Is that a fair way to coach the new people coming in?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. They always need to be aware of the political environment in which they operate, because that will kind of tell them where, you know, not only where the agency is going, what it's going to focus on, but also it's not just that, it's also Congress, because Congress kind of, you know, has the purse strings. So you also, just knowing what the budget looks like and, you know, how important that is going to determine also, how much leeway you're going to have as an OSHA employee to do the kind of work you want to do. And, if you're going to be understaffed or not, OSHA is always understaffed, but, the budget is an extremely and, you know, often overlooked. It's kind of seen as kind of a boring issue, but it's critically important. I mean, I think as President Biden and probably others have said, you know, that don't tell me what your priorities are, show me your budget, and that'll tell me what your priorities are. And that, you know, for better or worse is, a good place to look. Unfortunately, OSHA's budget has been very, very, meager and pretty much flat, you know, really for well over a decade. The last, you know, significant increase in OSHA's budget was in 2010, believe it or not. Ever since then, they've had, you know, some slight ups, some slight downs, but it's been more or less flat, which, you know, essentially, especially in days of inflation, means it's essentially OSHA sees a cut almost every year in its budget. And it's already a very small agency. So, you know, that's a problem. But you're right. I mean, you know, as any inspector or OSHA employee, it's important to be knowledgeable about the political environment and the budget environment in which you're operating.
Yeah, and I also tell them you're got to understand compliance letters, and especially the granddaddy of all, the field operation manual, which is currently section, which is 164. But I even remember back when you guys used to have the firm. I don't think too many people remember the firm before we got out of that one into the field operation manual, but because generally the inspectors will start reading the field information. I forgot the acronym now.
Reference manual?
Yes, reference manual. Yes. So first they're looking at the reference manual, and then they'll have to go back to the field operation manual back to back. So ridiculous. Yeah. So then they're like, all right, why do we need this document? So after a while, I honestly try to train, and I've been mentoring people who are new consultants. And I say, quite honestly, OSHA right now is really young, and we need the young people in here, but they're going to be doing some things that the experienced field operation manual people who understand those field, the COSHOs, they are disadvantaged right now because they're coming in, they have to hit the ground running after OSHA's been starved for so long during the COVID years, and they're going to be expected to do really hard enforcement unit style investigations, but they don't have the training that they need for it yet. So I told one of my talks is be kind to your COSHO, because honestly, they're learning right now, especially if they're, 2 years, 3 years in, they're not there yet. So you got to work with them, knowing that you may see this person often if they're in your area.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And no, that's important because we, those few times when we had enough you know, budget to hire new staff, you know, we had to make it clear to everyone that you don't hire someone today and they're you send them out on an inspection tomorrow. It really is a several year long process before they're trained up to really, you know, go out there more or less by themselves and then run things. So it's not an overnight kind of thing. And there's an enormous amount of training that OSHA inspectors, COSHAs have to go through before they're, you know, really ready to, you know, head out there on their own.
Yeah. Well, I don't want to take up too much time, but I just want to ask you one more thing about currently in safety. We've been seeing a shift in, I don't know, maybe it's like Crips in the blood. Everybody's either behavior-based safety or human and organization performance. You know, the two major thoughts right now, and Dr. Sidney Decker and also Dr. Todd Conklin with the HOP side, they are both, they had worked together with a book called Safety Differently, and it's almost like a new trend, if you would, and they're looking at safety, even the definition of safety, changing, where it's not what we do to people or the absence of injuries or illnesses, and I just made air quotes for those of you guys listening, you couldn't see that, but the absence of injury and illnesses as being now we're in a safe category, now we are safe, or our days away restricted transfer rates go down, and total recordable injury rates and experience modification is low, which are, you know, subjective rates anyway. People manipulate those all the time by hiring new, like taking on new companies, you know, all of a sudden their DART rates look lower because now the denominator has so many man hours. But now with the human organization and BBS, where are you right now with what do you think is an effective way of defining safety and actually making it work for the employer now?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think the main focus is through all this debate is if you want to really make workplaces safer for your workers is focusing in on unsafe conditions. If you can eliminate all the unsafe conditions in your workplace and, you know, make sure workers are trained, obviously, to work safely, you know, you're going to also eliminate, you know, almost all the potential for workers getting hurt in the workplace. The thing that I have never liked kind of about the behavioral focus, and I know a lot of people haven't liked this, is it's really, you know, focused on, you know, by definition, workers' behavior. And the outcome of that is if you just, you know, focus on workers being more careful, you know, everything will be fine. You know, unfortunately, that's not, you know, a good route to go in because, you know, people can try to be careful, but, you know, nobody can be careful 100% of the time, 100% of the days they work. I mean, that's why you have machine guards and all the other things that kind of are fall protection that kind of, you know, address, you know, the obviously human fallibility that is inevitably going to be there. So a lot of that you can essentially engineer out of the workplace, and otherwise, you know, you have, if you can just eliminate the hazardous situations in your workplace, whether those, you know, lead to falls or trench collapses or, you know, even chemical exposures or whatever you're looking at, lockout, tagout, if you eliminate the unsafe conditions in your workplace, you're going to have, you know, much better results, much better outcome than you will if you just keep exhorting people to be careful. Which isn't to say people shouldn't be careful. I mean, I'm not discounting that, but that is only a very small part of a comprehensive safety program.
They don't even think would just people be careful, you know, in certain situations our body chemistry takes over and, you know, we can have a release of some sort of cortisol or something else where at this point the prefrontal cortex is just shut down anyway. So you telling me to be careful and I have too much, you know, of that chemical release, you know, it doesn't mean anything to me. So.
Right. Or just, you know, people work 8-10 hours a day, you know, kind of doing the same thing. You get fatigued, you get bored, you know, a lot of cases, you know, companies say, well, you got to be careful here, but on the other hand, you've got a deadline to meet. You're getting these conflicting messages about whether you should work carefully or should I work fast? And, you know, those aren't always compatible. There's a lot of, you know, conflicting information and, you know, in the whole, you know, behavioral structure there that kind of ignores a lot of the more important factors.
Yeah, well, thank you so much, Mr. Bearab, for your time, and just everything that you've articulated to the audience and helping them understand OSHA a little bit better, and then also dealing with some of the fallacies out there about what OSHA can and can't do. And I just want to give you the opportunity for anything that you would like to share with the audience, any way that they could reach you, then please do. Any new projects coming up, please take this time to let the audience know.
Yeah, well, I've appreciated this. And again, I think one of my focuses now in my retirement is really educating the public about workplace safety, how to keep workplaces safe, the kind of political context that we're working in and how important, politics, unfortunately or fortunately, is to ensuring a safe workplace. To that purpose, I write a blog called Confined Space, which you can find at jordanbearab.com. I certainly encourage anybody to read it. You may not agree with it. I've got a comment section. I'm always happy to take criticisms, and I often respond to those. So you can certainly reach me through there. I'm just, again, happy to do this and happy to do anything I can to, encourage employers to make their workplaces safe and make sure that their workers, are able to come home alive and healthy at the end of every workday and hopefully live a long and healthy retirement as well.
Oh, man. Well, thank you so much for being part of the show. And I will absolutely, spread the word with you, because I believe in, okay, in everything.
All right,
you're
well,
saying.
Thanks for inviting me. I appreciate it. I think it's been fun.
Well, thank you.
That's a wrap for today's safety show. Remember, safety isn't just about hard hats and caution signs. It's about business smarts, too. Thanks for joining us on the Safety Consultant Show with Sheldon Primus. Until next time, stay safe, stay savvy, and keep consulting like a boss. Go get 'em. The views and opinions expressed on this podcast or broadcast are those of the host and its guests and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of the company. Examples of analysis discussed within the past hour, only examples. It should not be utilized in the real world as the only solution available, as they are based only on very limited and dated open source information. Assumptions made within this analysis are not reflective of the positions of the company. No part of this podcast or broadcast may be reproduced, stored in a retrieval system, or transmitted in any form or by any means, mechanical, electronic recording, or otherwise, without prior written permission of the creator of the podcast or broadcast, Sheldon Primus.
This episode has been powered by Safety FM.